Parthaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanu Santadhami Bhagavad Gita Bhagavatvaishini. Verse 7. Chapter 13, verse 7. Amanitvamadambitvam Ahimsakshantirarjavam Acharyopasanam shaucham Staryam atma vinigraha Amanitvam, Adambitvam, Ahimsa, Kshantihi, Arjavam, Acharya, Upasanam, Shaucham, Staryam, Atma, Vinigraha. In the first verse, there's a verse that's considered the first verse by some, but in this, the text that I have, the first verse where Bhagavan is speaking, Sri Bhagavan Vacha, he says to Kaunteya, the son of Kunti, to Arjuna, he says, this body, this shariram, is known as the kshetra, right? And the one who knows this body is known as the kshetrajna, the knower of the kshetra. Okay? Kshetra means field. So he uses the word kshetra for field of experience and locates the field of experience on this body, because in terms of your field of experience, anything external to the body, we know that's a field of experience. We know that as a field. But you usually take your body as the kshetrajna, as the knower of the field, right? And so Bhagavan just nips that in the bud immediately by saying, this body itself is the kshetra. This body itself is a field of experience. It is known. You're aware of your body through your sense organs, right? Just like you're aware of this field of experience through your sense organs, you're aware of the body through your sense organs. And then it goes further to, when we do a drikdrisha viveka, see or seeing analysis, we even recognize that, gee, even the sense organs themselves are a field. They're part of the field. They're part of the world of experience, because my mind is aware of the sense organs. The mind is the kshetrajna, the knower of the sense organs. And the sense organs are the kshetra. The sense organs are the kshetrajna to the objects of their perception. That would be the kshetra. So as you work more and more inward, we even find, well, even the mind itself is a kshetra. It is known. Every thought, every feeling, every emotion is known. So it's part of your field of experience. And so the kshetrajna, the knower of the field, keeps getting moved inward, you know, to where we resolve finally in the pratyagatma, that innermost self which can't be objectified into a field. So the ultimate knower. Ultimate knower, the knowership of the knower goes away, and what is left really is the Atman, conscious being, which is yourself. So he starts this with Arjuna. He says, this body is the field, and the one who knows that field, the wise, those who know, that one is called the kshetrajna. And in the very next verse he says, May you know, this is Krishna talking, may you know that I am the Kshetrajna. And Krishna's not going to be talking about his body, which is a field for him also, or his mind, or his sense organs. So here the Lord is saying, may you know that I am the Kshetrajna, the one who is the knower of the field. And he says, may you know that I am the Kshetrajna in all beings, which means that I, this conscious being, this Pratyek Atma, my innermost self, is the innermost self of all beings. Right? Which means not, I have an innermost self, and you have an innermost self, and you have an innermost self. He's not saying that. He's saying, I, the Kshetrajna, which I am, is the Kshetrajna, which is the self of all beings, which is the knower of the field, the one knower of the field of all beings. So there's a Mahavakya there. He said, and he says this in his next line. He says, it is the knowledge between the Kshetra and the Kshetrajna. The knowledge between these two, the knowledge of these two, that he says, according to me, in my opinion, Bhagavan talking, Swamiji always laughs at this when Krishna says something like this, my opinion, the Lord saying, this is my opinion. We take that as jnanam, as knowledge. This is knowledge. This is what the knowledge is. This is the knowledge that you seek. This is the end. In the end, this is the knowledge. This is what is to be known. He says that's in verse 2, and then this is that very long bhasha. Swamiji has about 30 pages on it. And then he begins to in verses 3, 4, 5, and 6. He describes the Kshetra. Okay. So that's what we've gone through. And now he's going to talk about the Kshetra, not the Kshetrajna, he's going to talk about the Jnanam, what he calls Jnanam. And what he means by Jnanam now, the knowledge, is what is, he's going to talk about the qualities of mind which allow this very important knowledge between the Kshetra and the Kshetrajna to take place. And so, in fact, there's a pramana, there's a means of knowledge that has to be in operation, which is really the unfoldment of the Vedanta Shastra, the unfoldment of the Bhagavad Gita, the unfoldment of the Upanishads as traditionally taught. There's a whole sampradaya of teaching where this knowledge acts as a pramana so that the student can actually see, can actually understand. But for the student to understand, or for the pramana means the means of knowledge to reveal your own nature to you, that pramana requires a mind, you know, for the pramana, for the means of knowledge to be able to, it's the mind that needs to contain or be, needs to be able to hold, needs to be able to see this vision. So now, let me just explain what we mean. So, Jnanam here is talking about the receptacle, the mind that is actually, in the end, the pramana. The mind is actually, in the end, what causes knowledge to take place, which allows for knowledge to take place. But let me explain. If I'm talking about pratyaksha, like sense perception, how that works, sense perception, as it's explained in the Vedanta, my eyes, with the use of my eyes, I'm able to perceive an object. Say, for instance, I'm looking at that painting. But that, through my eyes, my mind, using my eyes, creates an antakarna vritti, a thought modification. Because vritti means thought modification. We can call it a jnana vritti, a knowledge vritti, which is true to that object, through the use of my eyes. So we say the eyes are the pramana, the means of knowledge, to allow that thought modification to take place, which is then being illumined by consciousness. That thought modification becomes known, and so then I can say, I know the painting. But what is actually happening there is that the sense organs are allowing the mind to create a vritti, a thought modification, which is true to the object. And so in the end, it is the mind that becomes the means of knowledge for the painting to be known. But the sense organs allow for the mind to create that thought modification. Okay? Everybody with me so far? Now, when I'm looking at that painting, I can be in a really bad mood, and I'm still going to see the painting. I could be so angry, but I'm seeing the painting, you know? Or I could be hurt or in despair, or I could be so happy, you know? I could be exhausted. It doesn't really make any difference. It's just, even though all of these moods are there, my eyes are still giving me a vritti of the painting, even though I'm in a really bad mood, okay? Even though I'm selfish and violent. Thinking of some of these things.
Nasty.
I'm dishonest, I'm selfish, I'm violent, I'm nasty. All of these things. And there's the painting. No problem. But now, here, for Atmajnanam, self-knowledge to take place, okay, this is a little bit different. Because self-knowledge, let's just talk and see what that is. The self that you are, the conscious being that you are, is already present. You're not going getting knowledge of somebody else's self. Okay? But that self, you, that is present, until you gain knowledge, is totally superimposed upon, say, for instance, your mind. Why I say superimposition? It's not that you recognize yourself, which is illumining the thoughts, and that there's a discrimination of viveka between your being and the thoughts and the experiences that you are having, so that you can differentiate my being from the physical body, which is known to me, or differentiate me, my presence as I am, from the different thought modifications and moods that I'm experiencing. Usually this differentiation doesn't take place at all. If I have a mood, I am the mood. If my mind is happy, it's not my mind is happy, I am happy. I am sad, I am upset, I am agitated, I am thin, I am fat, I am old, I am tall. Whatever gunas, whatever qualities the body has, I am that. Whatever sense, my sense organs, if my eyes are 20/20, oh, I have very good vision, I see well, you know. Or my eyes, I'm losing my sight, my vision is dimming. My hearing is still fine. Well, actually, my hearing, I'm starting to lose my hearing. I don't hear as well as I used to. All identification. I. Right? So now, this is what we take for granted. That's why Krishna starts out saying, this is the kshetra. These things that you identify with, these are the kshetra, you know. Knowledge really is to be able to differentiate the kshetra, which includes the body, the mind, the sense organs, even the ahankara, the I notion, all the thought modifications. This thing that makes you in terms of the jiva, means the body, mind, sense organs. We call it the karya karana sangata, this body, mind, sense organs complex. This whole thing is the kshetra. Yeah. Knowledge is the differentiation, to being able to have a knowledge which is pratak, means viveka, between you and the kshetra, this field of experience. Now, in order for this differentiation knowledge to take place, you need a mind. Right? Because the mind is the one that has the problem. The mind is the one that is suffering from the lack of differentiation. And so it's the mind that has to be able to see this, to gain this viveka. Conscious being, me, has no problem. The consciousness, the conscious self, the I, not the word I, but who I actually am, it's not the kshetra. The I is not a changing field of experience. The self, the conscious being, is the me, is the one who's always there, and because of whom all of these changing experiences are known, because of whom the kshetra is known. The body, the mind, the moods, the emotions, the perceptions, the world. This kshetra is known because of me. So there's a viveka to be had there. Now, the viveka has to take place in the mind. Okay? Now the problem here is I can have be agitated and see the painting, but the agitated mind or the distracted mind, you know, or the mind that is full of raga dvesha, likes and dislikes, the mind that is full of judgments, you know, the mind that is in pain, that mind is not so available to be a mirror, to act as a mirror, or to be able to differentiate itself from the one who is innermost and as though illumining it. Just think about this. Yourself is not going to have as your nature the attributes of the things that are being illumined, including the attributes of the mind. Okay? So for instance, it's just like I don't have the attributes of the painting. I'm aware of the painting, but the attributes of the painting belong to the painting. So I would say the painting and the painting's attributes belong to it. They don't belong to me. They don't describe me, right? So now what about me if I start removing the attributes from me of the things that are illumined, the things that I'm aware of, I can describe, I watch change. So say, for instance, the mind. I'm aware of my mind. So I'm aware of the mind, I'm free of the mind. Subject, object, I'm aware of the mind, so I'm free of the mind. The mind is changing, I'm aware of it's changing, therefore I'm free of it. The mind changes, I remain the same. There's a viveka there. I'm aware of the mood, therefore I'm free of the mood. I'm aware of the anger, therefore I'm free of the anger. See that? But now, my mind is full of anger, say. And an angry mind is going to have a little bit of problem recognizing me, who I am, in reference to itself. It need not have a problem, but there is a problem there. Anger is an overpowering emotion, and it draws the attention of the mind to it. Just like, say, if I were to have hurt my arm, and the arm was causing me pain, the pain draws my mind to it. It draws my attention. It's the pain that needs to be healed. Right? That's an important thing to know. Whether it's physical, it draws your attention, it needs your attention, it needs to be healed. When there's pain in your mind, agitation in your mind, hatred, likes, dislikes, all of these type of things, it draws your attention to it because it has to be taken care of. It's causing you pain. So far, so good? You have to recognize all this as a fact. So just a little aside on this fact. That is why when we're learning meditation or learning how to be with our body or with others, with our body or with our mind, we have to understand that when the mind is in pain or when it is hurt or when it is agitated, you know, it needs our attention. We can't just try to bypass it. It doesn't work. It'll just run along with you. You know, you can't really bypass it. You have to learn how to be with it in a way to release that pain. Just like you would if you've hurt yourself physically, you would go to a doctor, you would take aspirin, you would do whatever you need to do to relieve the body of that pain, and it will keep calling you to do so until you do it. And for the mind, it's the same way. And so there are certain attitudes that we have that we've picked up along the way, and a lot of them are complex-based, which cause pain in the mind, and therefore it brings the buddhi's attention, your intellect's attention, the witness, the intellect's attention, to that to try to solve the problem. And now you're trying to make this mind recognize me, when what it wants to do, the whole mind wants to do, is solve the suffering that it's experiencing, just like the body. You know, say your arm's falling half off and you're in class trying to listen to Vedanta. You know, there's something about your arm that is saying, could you please take care of me first? I'm in terrible pain, you know. And the mind is like that also. So this is well known. This is this understanding is right here. This is exactly what Krishna's talking about here. The things that cause pain in the mind need to be analyzed and taken care of, especially when they're generated by attitudes. We have to understand. We have to gain a value for these values so that the mind can have a relative shanti. And it needs that relative shanti in order to differentiate, to be able to fully differentiate, to have the inner space to differentiate the mind, for the mind to be able to differentiate between itself and its attitudes and its perceptions and its thoughts and moods and feelings, to be able to differentiate itself and all of its attributes from me. To be able to fully differentiate the mind and its attributes from me, it needs to be able to recognize me without interference from itself. I'd say without too much interference from itself. Yeah, you know. Otherwise, it's causing too much, there's too much competition, you know, between the affects of the mind, the worries of the mind, the desires of the mind. There's too much competition between the draw of that and the freedom, and the freedom of my own presence. And so here, that's why these list of qualities that we're going to go through, you know, are called jnanam. Because the jnanam all has many different meanings. Jnanam is the knowledge itself, it's also the means of knowledge, and it's also the vehicle for the knowledge. So the mind is that place where the knowledge takes place, right? Here, the knowledge itself is not something that's going to be gained through sense perception. It's gained through a teaching methodology that is making your mind focus and recognize and differentiate your own self, you know, from the experiences that are coming and going. And so in order to be able to do that, the mind has to have some natural shanti, some natural relaxation, some natural peace, so that it can do that act of recognition. If it has too much agitation, it doesn't even want to do it. It won't even be sitting in the class. Mm-hmm. It has other things it wants to do. It is busy. You just feel trapped. You know? But there's such a thing as a mumukshu, somebody who really needs this knowledge and does want to know, who am I really? You know, is there any way out of this dvaita, of these dwandras, of all of these opposites, any way that I can get off the Can I get off the wheel of samsara? So let's say it in India, the samsara chakra, that wheel of samsara. Everything is in constant change, and there's nothing that I can really hang on to, or just no place to sit down and relax, because that place itself is unstable. And so is there any point of stability? That's one of the ways of talking about the quest of a mumukshu, somebody who wants to be free, find a place where I can say, I am free. Everything that is to be done has been done. Sometimes they use this term for somebody who has knowledge. Kritya krityaha. A jnani, one who has knowledge, is a kritya krityaha. Krityaha means what is to be done, kritya, has been done. What is to be gained has been gained. Another way they describe sometimes, the jnani is the one who has an alam buddhi. Buddhi means the mind, the buddhi. Its natural condition is alam. Alam means enough. It's like saying, would you like another helping of food? No, I'm fine, I'm full, I've had enough, you know? That alam buddhi. When in your situation you're fine, you don't really need or ask for, it's enough, I'm fine, it's fine. Do you need any more water? No, I have plenty of water. Are you warm enough? Yeah, I'm warm enough. What do you need? No, I'm fine. I really am fine. When that's true, I'm fine. That's an alam buddhi, you know. So the jnani is the one who's fine. Why is fine? Well, because the self is fine. You are fine. Your being is fine. But there's on another level also. The mind itself, which has owned up to this knowledge, is really not in competition with it. Right? A mind that has had the time to assimilate this knowledge and the values that go with it is not in any competition with it. So the mind itself is fine. You know, the mind saying, I am fine, when the mind says, I am fine, it can be referring to me, who is always fine, because the self is always fine. So it's, yeah, I'm fine. Yeah, no, everything is fine. Nothing's happening. I'm good. But it can also be referring to itself. I am fine, because I'm no longer am tortured by these ragged dvesha's, these likes and dislikes, or this judgmental mind, or all of these kind of complexes and things that cause so many problems. You know, those things have finally fallen off, and thank God I'm relaxed, I'm good. It can be talking about itself, the mind. So here, this jnanam, these attitudes, these values, and Swamiji has written this book called Value of Values that I highly recommend for everybody. His book, Value of Values, is going through all of these values. And these values are used as a sadhana, because once they're understood, they can be used as something which you understand and can work towards. They're not meant for you to criticize yourself, like, I'm bad because I don't have that value. It's not that at all. It's that these are values that we have, and we work toward them, you know, until they become natural toward us. And all of these values are like that. They're just values that my antakarana, my mind, holds in esteem because of understanding. And they're values that as you mature in the light of your knowledge, these values just become natural. So you're actually, your experience is even now watching yourself grow into these values, which are come naturally from your knowledge. And also, it's very helpful to take them one by one and unfold them, you know, so that you really gain a value for the values, so that they become something that when you're behaving in another way, you have that value, you know, to work towards, you know. So let's look at these. The first one, and I think I've told you this probably several times, but these four verses, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. These five verses, usually brahmacharis and sannyasis chant these every morning. You know, like, amani tvam madam bhutam ahimsa chanti arjavam. But when, as you know what they mean, and they just give your mind, you know, like a scaffolding, you know, to hang your actions on. That's beautiful. Really. So, amani tvam. When you say that twa, mani, twa, makes it an abstract, the state of. So let's go to the mani first. The negates it. So mani is one who has this mana. Mana means, it's in a sense, it's kind of a need and a desire. A need and a desire for recognition and acknowledgement. Like, say, for instance, you have accomplished something. They've accomplished something. Then you want people to acknowledge that you've accomplished this. Or that you're making a lot of money and you're very wealthy. You want people to treat you as though you're making a lot of money and are very wealthy. You know? Or if you are in some sort of a powerful position, you want to make sure that powerful position, you know, is sufficiently acknowledged, you know. And you'll find yourself with this, you know, some people will always praising yourself. You know, if you've been in situations where you have people like this who are always talking about themselves and always praising themselves and their exploits and what they did and what they got and, you know, how much money they made and, you know, who they met, name dropping and all of this. this type of, I think Swamiji calls it shlagan, that's the Sanskrit word, a person who's always involved in telling how great they are, and they feel also that you should be telling them how great they are.
What was the name in Sanskrit, the word?
Shlagana.
Wow, it sounds Yiddish, doesn't it?
Let me see that word.
Is this Sanskrit?
Yeah, Sanskrit. Shlaganam. Atmanah shlaganam. Listen to this. The mani is one who makes his virtues known to others and demands to be respected for them. That's perfect. But he goes on for quite a few pages about this. The problem is that that particular, just a little psychology on that I think is helpful. That particular need is really something which is coming in from a deep insecurity inside. You know, and it's important to really understand these things. You can understand it in yourself if you find yourself, you know, weak in this area or having this problem, or in others also. It comes from a deep insecurity of yourself that you are not worthy. Now, one thing to know that when we look, you know, in child development, like in the first especially 3 or 4 years, by the way, Carl Jung, who is a psychologist I follow and admire very much, what he said is we spend our whole life working out the first 3 years. Not really funny, but it's true. But anyway, to remember, if you've ever had children or nieces or nephews, you know, or brought up your own little ones, your brothers and sisters, you know, the little child is the center of everybody's attention. You know, like if you're in with your family, there's the little baby, and everybody's just sitting around talking about and staring at the baby. You know, if you go to a friend's house who's just had a baby, what do you all do? You all sit around and you stare at the baby and coo at the baby and say how wonderful the baby is. You know, and parents will always feel, in the best of all worlds, that there is nobody cuter than my little baby. This is the cutest little baby. There could be nobody better than my little baby. Okay, and so the child grows up internalizing this very, very important, you know, flow of admiration of and love. It gets internalized. And so what happens is, with that internalization, you know, inside they have, inside of themselves, the feeling that I am fine, I am good, I am important, you know, I am an important little person. I used to notice this when I was in India in the 70s, because Indians, everyone, every country has their problems, every people have their problems. You know, everything has a shadow side also, but one thing that I used to love is that in India, the parents are very close and very doting on their children. Their children are around them all of the time, you know. And they're out there, so they're always being watched, they're always being cared for, they're always like little entities that are part of the family. And at the same time, they're respected and they're given a lot of freedom to be little people, you know, within the confines of that family structure. So it's a very close-knit family structure. And so I used to notice these little ones, you know, they're like 2, 3, 4 years old, and they would be just walking around like this little, you know, this little tiny girl who was like a little person. And
like
the little boys.
Like they're somebody.
Yeah, little somebodies, you know, with such kind of a confidence and sense of wholeness and wellness. Well, that's because they're smothered with attention and love. All of this is internalized. And so they get a very strong self-structure. And that self-structure, they don't need to say, you know, I'm worthy, I'm an important person. They don't need to say that because they know that they are. I'm an important person, you know. I'm loved. They don't need those words because they have internalized that. Now, when that's not internalized, it doesn't feel good inside, you know. And so, growing up, there'll be, I'm an important person. I've done this and I've done that. Love me, love me, love me. Look at what I've done. Look at what I've done. Look at how much money I've made. You know? Look at how well I did in school. I did well, better than all of these people in school. You know? Look at how good I am at this and at that. Why don't you look at me how good I am? So it's a demand. It becomes a demand. And sometimes it can be, you know, an angry type of demand. Sometimes it can be kind of a whimpering kind of demand. Depends on that kind of the personality and the situation. But nevertheless, it's a demand. Sometimes it can be kind of a, it's kind of a heartbreaking demand. You know, I remember I had this experience once when one elderly man, had written a book, and it was a big, thick book, big book. And he was walking around to everybody, you know, saying, I wrote this book. I wrote this book. See my book, you know. That's a hurt inside. At least it's like, I wrote a book, I'm somebody. I wrote this book, I am really somebody because I wrote this book, you know. But the way, why you do that is because I don't feel like I'm somebody. So I need this. These clothes make me somebody. Don't you see how much money I have? That makes me worthwhile. So that, these are the type of complexes that cause that type of thinking. Because if you feel complete inside, then there's nothing to say. You are somebody, so you don't have to say that you're somebody, you know. And not only that, that's another part of this Amanitam. You don't need to have anything to be somebody. You think that this thinking you need to have somebody, something, or to show off something to be somebody means you don't have any, you're not somebody inside. And this being somebody inside comes from when you're little. You're somebody, and so it doesn't matter what you have. You can have nothing. You know? And it doesn't matter what you look like. It matters what you look at like if you think that you have to look like something in order to be somebody. You know? Or it matters how much money you have if you think money is going to contribute to your being somebody. But actually none of these things contribute to your being somebody at all. And that's why the problem becomes so severe. It's because you can't satisfy it. And nobody can give you enough praise to make you feel like you're somebody, because the problem isn't out here. The problem is with that very hurt part inside. And so when we recognize that manitvam in ourself, what we want is the amanitvam. The unnegates it. A person who has the amanitvam does not need to praise themselves or to have others praise them, because their well-being doesn't need that. They already have as their nature what they would be hoping to get from that type of thing. You see what I mean? And so what we have to understand in ourselves is, to whatever degree we have that need, if somebody needs to show respect, or we have to tell everybody what we've done or how much money we've made or whatever it is, that there's somebody inside who's not feeling, is feeling insecure. And then all of that inner child work that we do is then needs to be applied to that. You know? And so to understand a value like amanitvam, it's not about criticizing myself. It's about realizing where the problem is, that there's an insecurity there. There's someone inside that doesn't feel whole, that feels that, you know, I need to be respected by other people in order to be respected, because that sense of respect isn't inside. I need to be loved by other people to be loved, to feel loved, because I don't feel loved inside. If I felt loved inside, then I don't... People can love me or not love me, but I feel loved inside. And that's a structure that we can get from our growing up those first 4 years. And if not, we have to go back inside, you know, and work with that part of ourself to kind of re-raise that little child, you know, in a healthy environment. An environment that has to do with love and respect and joy and appreciation. Just imagine what a little baby, you know, with loving parents gets, so much love, joy, appreciation, so much wonder. It's just taking all of that in. So it has that, it's a structure. We have to now go back and give that to ourselves. And with this knowledge, all of this inner work, it works so well with this knowledge, because with this knowledge, the very source of the love or the ananda that you're seeking from the outside, the fulfillment that you're seeking from the outside, you recognize as being your very swarupa, your very self. And so that self from the inside, as you discover that, bathes these insecure parts. And your buddhi, the way the buddhi, your mind has learned to hold those insecure parts, also helps them to heal and become free. So we're not in a beggarly position. Beggarly in the sense that I need you to praise me. I need you to praise me. Why do I need you to praise me? Because I don't feel worthy, you know. Otherwise, if I felt okay, I wouldn't need that. It's because I don't feel. I don't have it. So I need it from you. And I really need it. That's why it's so frustrating if I don't get it. You get very angry if you don't get it. Mm-hmm. Because of the pain inside. You can't take that for granted, you know. But the thing is, that pain is so painful that instead of recognizing where it is located in myself, I won't look inside, I'll just become rageful outside. I'll project all of the anger and all of the pain outside, you know, and then get mad at who's ever not giving me the type of praise that I need, because it's too painful to go inside and to realize the insecurity and the lack of feeling loved inside. But once we can start going inside to actually feel it and be with it, then we can do a lot. And this knowledge itself does a lot, because this knowledge is the very source of the ananda that we seek. You know, and so we can heal. The psyche can be healed. You know. We just don't have to know how. And a lot of it has to do with giving the love that was not giving the love and the respect to the part that's hurt that it didn't get before. That's all. That's it. It's just waiting for you. It's waiting for you to come and take care of it and to give it what you're so longing, what it's so longing for, and projecting out onto your buddhi and then out into the world to try to get it. So that's the amanic twim, and as that is understood, we can recognize any weakness in ourselves, any hurt in ourselves around that area. The next one is adambitvam. Adambitvam is a little bit different. That twa is again the abstract. It's the state of being, not having this dambi, this dumba. Dumba is a difference. The amanic twam, for the person who has this mana, that person brags about their qualities, good qualities, or accomplishments, and wants respect. The poor dumbi, this is a really bad one. This is a real sad one. But one who has the dumba projects qualities that they don't have, or attributes that they don't have. You know, like Swamiji's used the example of a person who is going to invited to a very important party, you know, and only has rags, doesn't have any good clothes or anything, and so goes and borrows from someone, or rents or something, a really nice outfit with nice shoes, nice everything, nice clothes, and goes to the party, you know, and gets all of his money together, and goes to the party and acts as though he's a wealthy person. Yeah. And so this is like a double problem. It's that I don't even have any good enough in my mind. I don't even have any good qualities that I could brag about so that you would praise me. And so what I have to do, I can't even find any qualities like that in myself. And so I make them up, you know. I make up the qualities and then present myself as having attributes or qualities or successes that I actually don't have at all, just so that I can experience what it must be like for people who do have these qualities. I don't have them myself, but I can pretend and just for a moment, you know, feel like I'm okay. So that's a very interesting to think about that, you know. I've noticed it in myself in this way. And this is why I always try to, I always make sure not to fall for it, because it's very common among scholars or people who know, who have studied or have some mastery in a subject matter. You know, in any knowledge that you have, and it's no matter how much knowledge you have, actually. Say you have, in any subject, say you have an incredible amount of knowledge in a given subject. So here's this, you could have, you're just starting, you have this little tiny bit of knowledge, but then say you've been studying for many years and now your knowledge is like this. Okay? Now you have this much knowledge. This is huge compared to this. But now when you have this much knowledge, the amount that you know that you don't know is only this much. It's like that. It's like they use the example of a flashlight. If you have a little flash beam of light, it lights up just a little dot on this, you know. But around that dot is darkness. But the dot is really tiny, and so the darkness that you're aware of, right, the darkness that you're aware of, is less, right? Because it's such a tiny little circumference, so you just know, well, I know this, but this little bit of stuff I don't know. Now say, this is what they always talk about with pundits. It's there's verses about this. A pundit in India has an incredible amount of knowledge like this, or like this. But look at how, say, look at it as a beam of light, you know. Look at how much darkness is being illumined. This is all the big, I don't know, you know. Now say they know this much. Now look at how much is illumined, how much darkness is illumined. This is all I don't know. So now what they say for pundits or for scholars, masters, you know, they are the most humble people. They're the most humble people because of the amount of knowledge they know that they don't know. The amount that they know that they don't know. And that is such an important thing. And so one thing that I do about that, because this is what comes up as a teacher, you have to say you don't know all the time. Because there will always be something that comes up that you don't know. So you have to get very used to saying, I don't know. You know?
I don't know.
I don't know. So I make sure to say, I don't know. I make sure to look things up in the dictionary. I make sure to do all of that, because if you don't, you can be embarrassed that you don't know. So you have to incorporate not knowing into your knowing. You understand? Mm-hmm. It's a very, very important thing. Otherwise you actually become fraudulent, you know, and you're also not a good role model for your students. Because then they don't know that they can't know. You know, so you have to be free. You have to be free to say, I don't know. I actually learned that from Swamiji, you know, because he has so much knowledge, you can never kind of get to the end of it. Mm-hmm. But then something will come to his mind about a word or something, and he'll bring out all the dictionaries. You know, and be looking at him and get lost in his dictionary. And we'll all be sitting there waiting.
Just like here.
Well, yeah, I do that. I do it too. But I have a value for it. You know, I don't do it as long as Swamiji. Swamiji gets lost in it. And he'll be looking and figuring all of this out. And, you know, and then he's always very free to say, I don't know. And he'll have like Chandrama, you know, in Rishi, go and pull out one of his books. He has takes care of his library. He'll ask for the books to be pulled out, and sometimes he'll get Sakshat Kritananda. He'll call him in, and they'll be looking through these books. You know, it's knowledge. It's that freedom to explore, freedom to know, freedom to not know and be curious. You know, it's such a it's a big thing. Once I had, and when I once I had this experience where, I don't know if I can tell the story properly, but anyway, what happened was many years ago when I was at the ashram in India, we had a very well-known pundit come to give us about 10 days worth of talks on the darshanas, the six philosophical systems in India, which would be, you know, like the Bauddha, and the Charvakas, the Bauddha, the Vaisheshikas, the Sankhyas, all of these different philosophical systems that when you're studying Vedanta, one of the things you end up learning is all of these, and doing this Purvapaksha Siddhanta where you do this compare and contrast. And so this great scholar came and was giving us very detailed lectures. And one day, of course, we didn't know it all, but one day he made some very embarrassing mistake in his unfoldment of one of the darshanas. I'm sorry I don't remember the details of it, but he made a very embarrassing mistake, and he didn't catch the mistake in that lecture, you know. And so in the next lecture, then he had realized what he had done, and he came back and he told us the mistake that he made. Okay, but the thing is, he was horrified. He was so horrified that he made that mistake, because in a way, in his mind, I don't remember all the details here, but it was kind of like he felt that it revealed that he didn't really know what he was talking about. That's how he felt. That by the making of that mistake, it pulled off a shroud of as though he's a phony.
Not authentic.
Not authentic. But, and he went through so much mortification over this, you know. But now, the thing, this is the thing. This is exactly what people are afraid of. This is exactly what people are afraid of when they say the I don't know. That type of mortification, you know? And his going through that, it made it real. I don't know if I can explain this or not, but it was very poignant. It was very shocking. The thing is, the fact is that he had a huge amount of knowledge. Huge. He just slipped up in this one little thing. You know, in India they have everything memorized and they just blurt out everything. This is incredible. You know, but if you don't do that, then it's an ego crusher. Because something went askew and he blurted out a whole bunch of wrong things of one about one darshana that belonged to another darshana, and he just messed it up completely.
He was drunk.
No? But it was ego crushing. That's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. You know? Because in his eyes, in order for him to really be a pundit, these kind of things could never happen. You know? And so, anyway, I don't know, all of these things tie together, but it has to do with this, you know, thinking that you should be one way in order to be meaningful. And if you can't keep that, you have to keep the facade up. You know, so say you're good at something, but in your mind you should be a little bit better. But then it's a facade. You know, you should just be what you are. Know what you are, know what you're doing, and be fine with it. And so if you think that you have to be better than what you are, or have more money than you have, or have more power than you do, then you have to pull yourself back and see what's that all about. You know? It takes some analysis. Swamiji says this over and over. It's important to understand this when we go through these values. It's not to criticize yourself. It's not about self-criticism. It's about setting yourself free. You know, it's setting yourself free from these things that don't allow us to be, you know. Why should you care if you don't know something? Why can't that be interesting? It's because we think that in order for me to be worthy, I have to be different than what I am. Right? The mani, the one who has this mana, they don't have that problem. I have all these things, so praise me. They really do have the things. The one who has the dhamma is even what you have. You may have lots of things, but those don't count at all to you. And so you fake it by pretending you know more than you do, you know, or that you have more money than you do, or you have more position than you do. Because what you have doesn't count. So if you search, I mean, you can find some people have pathological degrees of this. And then there's the rest of us who have normal degrees of this. You'll find them in yourself in this way or another, where you're extending yourself beyond what you really are because you think that will make you more respected, more loved, more meaningful, you know, more whole. And so that's why making these things clear in your mind, then you can come back to yourself. It's a sadhana. Come back to yourself and set yourself free from all of these. And so each one of these, like if you read the handout, be sure to read Swamiji's handout. He's gone quite a bit into each one of these, Amani, Tvam, and Dhambi, Tvam, and then we'll go on and do more. We'll do two or three each time. These ones, these first two, Amani, Tvam, and Dhambi, Tvam, he's spent a lot of time on these because they take away, you know, our freedom. They really take away our freedom. We have to walk around with a mask. We're like walking around with a lie, in one, especially the Adambi tone. You know, but both of them are, there's just a lot of pain inside around those areas, and so it takes a lot of work, a lot of inner child work, you know, a lot of contemplation also, as we get more, and we'll see more into Nidhi Dhyasana, contemplation where you just give your mind a chance to be with who you really are. You know, who you really are is so whole and strong and complete, you know, just as your very nature, just the very nature of your being is so solid. You know, everything that everyone ever wants and is ever seeking is who you are underneath the layers of insecurities and problems we have in the mind. And so that's why as we go through each one of these values, the mind gets, as we own them, the mind gets relieved of a lot of tension, you know, that causes a lot of pain in the mind. So that's why all of these values are meant to relieve you, help you to give up the stress that these cause, you know, and help us work toward being able to own up the opposite. So the of the manitvam means the one who is free of that mana. The of the dambitvam negates it, the one who is free of that, those false pretenses, you know. So, okay, let's stop there. Prachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om. Hi Anne, hi Susan. Didn't see you earlier.
Yeah. Could maybe develop this a little bit, or the, I appreciated the your description of the child rearing, what you saw the child rearing practices in India. Could you contrast that a little bit to what you feel like you've seen here, or what is missing that the child doesn't get?
Well,
or what is, or.
You know, maybe some of it's also just cultural, and I think children here, I mean, in good families, children here are very loved, but a lot of times both the mother and father have to work. Also, it's a nuclear family without an extended family. You know, in an extended family, I'm sure that has its shadow side, as does everything. But in an extended family, there's always the aunts and uncles, you know, and grandparents that the little children are. There's always a lap, you know. There's always somebody to take care of the stress. You know, just imagine, it's hard to believe that in our era, there's only a mother and a nuclear family, the mother, the father, and the kids. Father goes off to work, and sometimes the mother does also. But it's just so stressful. It's 24/7 trying to take care of your little children, you know, without any help. I know, because I, as a psychologist, I see, especially mothers, good mothers, who love their children, who are trying to take care of them alone, when the husband is out working, and good husband, good wife, good family. But how to handle it, you know, without help. Whereas, you know, in the India with the extended family, there's always a lap, and the mother's very rarely working, you know. So
the little child feels
always important, always there. Like, I remember one family that I'm very close to in India. Now they're all adults. All the kids are adults. But when she had three children, but I'm thinking about her two little girls. These little girls, 2 years old, 3 years old, 4 years old, 5 years old, they were the mom. They were like little ducklings, you know. And wherever their mom would go, here these two little girls would be going. They were like a little threesome going around everywhere, you know. And it was just, they were just so contained, you know, so cared for. And it's just has to do with the structure and the culture. They're having trouble now too, because now they're becoming more nuclear family. Both parents are working and wanting to be out in the world and all of that. And so the children aren't having quite the same level of being important little people, you know. But I think for us, and we have a lot of broken families now, at least half of the families are broken. That puts a lot of stress on the mother, father, and children.
So as a child is young and growing, it needs that kind of admiration and that kind of looking after, and everything is okay, and you're...
The admiration, that's a good word for it, actually. You know, Freud even used to, you know, the famous psychologist would even talk about the child as the king. The king and the queen, little girl. The little queen bee, little king, you know, from the doting parents. It's almost organic, you know. It's not like the parents are trying to be like that. It's all kind of built in. They've done studies on it, actually, you know, the physiological, psychological attachment, for instance, of the mother. How it is weaned from her as much as from the child over a period of years. you know, when it starts, it's all, even when the child is born, but it's still as though it's part of her. You know, very hard to let it, to have any distance from it. And slowly, slowly, physiologically, the chemistry and all, it allows for that parting over, you know, 2 or 3 years' time. It's very interesting, you know, so it's kind of all in Bhagavan's plan.
That, except, you know, when it doesn't, that's smother love, right?
Yeah, is when something goes wrong. When something goes wrong because of external circumstances or mental illness or who knows, there's so many variables. And then we need the tools as adults to be able to take care of those things that we didn't get, you know, deprivations or things that cause went awry. That's what psychology is all about, really, is learning how to repair the damage, you know. And with Earth, there's always going to be something. Some's more extreme for some people than others. But how to repair that. And it is repairable, is the thing. You know? You can't get rid of your past as though it didn't happen. You know? And you can't get rid of the painful experiences and the hurts that they caused. But they just aren't, they're scars instead of pussy wounds.
What?
Scars instead of pussy wounds. You know? Scar tissue builds, it's your character. All of the things that happen to you build your character. But some are very, you know, really festering wounds inside that can be healed. And then what's left is a scar, but it's not unmanageable. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take over, you know, and rule you. Those, in a way, those scars, scar tissue, or whatever you want to call it, like, you know, they also give you, there's a lot of good things that those things give you. They give you depth and empathy and understanding and being able to have compassion and care, you know, to be able to empathize with other people. It's not an all. Suffering is not all bad. You know, suffering has a positive side too. It gives us a lot of strength and care for others.
Compassion.
Yeah, that kind of goes back to what you were saying at the beginning about how mental pain draws the attention of the buddhi and makes it more difficult to make the viveka. And, you know, I'm kind of wondering about that, because in a way, you have to have, like, this perfect, serene environment, and everything has to be
copacetic
to make the viveka. I mean, you know, it is a matter of degree. And yet Arjuna here is in the middle of a battle, and you know,
yes,
in our lives some of us are battling in terms of, you know, maybe our profession or some other way. And
but I don't think it's the external battle that causes the problem. You can deal with all the external battles like a warrior, you know, with objectivity. But like how to deal with this, there's many difficult situations. Mm-hmm. You can deal with those objectively, or your mind can become very frayed by them because of your own complexes and own hurts. So the thing is, when that is so, then we have to know how to be with those complexes, you know, so as to give them a chance to grow and to become strong and to be, you know, how to give them love and to give them support, you know, give them care. So that those complexes can transform into strength, some things that make your mind strong. So it's not like everything has to be just calm and beautiful on the externally. But internally, what I'm saying is that when your mind is hurt by complexes, by your likes, your dislikes, by your judgments, by your hurts and pains and the depressions and all of these type of emotional stuff, then that mind is not really available for Shravana. But what it is, if Shravana means being exposed to this teaching at that time, I mean, I remember myself, like in the 70s when I was with Swamiji in India and he was teaching, you know, I remember sitting on my cot one day, crying my eyes out, saying, "What Brahman? Who cares?" Because I was in all this emotional pain, you know. And what I wanted to take care of was all of this pain I was in. Who cares about Brahman? But see, the thing is that when your mind is in emotional pain or hurt or there's a strong desire, then we need to take care of that first. You know, if you can take care of that first, if you know how to be with it, then that hurt part will calm down, you know, because it's been cared for. And then you can do your shravana. But if you don't know how to take care of these reactions inside, don't know how to be with them in a way that they can be transformed or settled down, you know, your mind's not available for shravana. It's not that you have to, don't get me wrong, saying, first we have to totally settle down the mind.
Get a perfect mind.
Get the perfect mind, and then we can do shravana. Mm-hmm. And we're doing shravana all along. But we're also learning how to be with the mind in a way that can help it, can take care of it. You know, it's just like a little baby. When a little baby is having a temper tantrum and so very upset, you know, you can't tell it to go do its homework. You know, the temper tantrum will just get worse. Stop your temper tantrum and go do your homework. You know, you have to know how to be with that child, you know, to take care of it and let it work through its process, and then it can go and do what it needs to do. But what if you don't know that? That's what I'm talking about. What if you don't know, you don't have the psychology, you don't have, know how to be with yourself, with your mind, so that it can get some relief and that it can heal and grow, and, you know, some of these open wounds can, you know, the sadnesses of the little child, you know, can be soothed. Is the difference clear?
Yeah, yeah. And it seems like, you know, someone like Nisargadatta, who's a different tradition, but, mm-hmm. you know, chain-smoking BDs, and if you've seen video or seen him in person,
yeah.
I mean, he's very, he seems agitated on one level, mm-hmm. but you know that he's not on another.
Yeah.
You know, or you know, so just because someone's in a profession, like, say, a stockbroker,
yeah.
where they're on, and they're on the floor,
yeah,
not a stockbroker,
and totally wild.
One
yeah.
of those guys, yeah. And they're screaming
yeah.
and yelling, and
but they can be fine inside.
I know that as a lawyer, in order to be good in certain situations, there's a need to be very emotionally engaged.
Yeah.
In the battle.
Yeah.
And
in the battle.
See the other side as the enemy.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, and it just that's what it takes to bring the best out.
Yeah.
But that's not necessarily a contradiction.
No, because you can be objectively doing that.
And by objectively doing that, it doesn't mean that you're somehow emotionally cold.
No.
It's
a choice.
Yeah. You can be like that, but it's unlikely.
Can be like what?
This stock trader being really calm inside and
no, wait a minute.
Some bankster being
you can even you, no, no. This isn't about not having any responses or emotions or feelings. But it's different to allow yourself to have those as opposed to being overwhelmed by them. You know? Like I could do trading and you get all revved up and I've done trading before so I know what that is. You get all revved up and you're in it. But you haven't lost yourself. You know? Or you can have totally lose yourself in it.
Well, like they say in certain martial arts, that the key is not that you never lose it, but that you recover extremely quickly.
Or
faster and faster as you, you know, to the point where then other people don't even see that you lost it and recovered. It just looks seamless.
All right, you can say that. I can go with that. That's on the level of the mind, and that's fine. I can understand that, what you're saying. I can even talk about that. But there's another level, and that's your own being, mm-hmm. that nothing's happening to. With the other, it can, like, almost like between thoughts, you recover yourself. It can be so fast. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, it could be like that, yeah. With someone who's like a master or whatever their discipline is.
Yeah.
It reminds me of what you said, that Swamiji, you know, said something about he meditates between the thoughts.
Yeah, yeah. I was just kind of referring to that. Now there's another thing to be said about this also, is that if your mind goes off on a trip, it will come back. You know, so say your mind goes off on a daydream or it gets too involved in something, it will quickly come back. And it doesn't matter, because nothing happens to you. Yourself isn't ever going on any kind of a trip. You know, so if your mind gets lost in its machinations, the more time goes on with that you've assimilated this knowledge, the less time is, that doesn't take very much time to bring the mind back. Because it's going in a direction that's causing pain or upset, and that's not worth it to you. And it doesn't have the strength to kind of run on its own. And so you just bring it back. But even if you didn't bring it back, it wouldn't make any difference. It would just run itself out, and then you would bring it back. It doesn't matter, is what I'm saying.
That question about likes and dislikes and strong desires being sort of disruptive to this sort of thing that you're working towards. And I was wondering if a very strong desire for self-knowledge could also, I mean, is that the same as any?
I want to say two things about that. First of all, say you have a very strong desire for something, and it's not a dharmic, then there's no reason not to pursue that strong desire, but with that, what we call that prasada buddhi, where you accept the results of your efforts as prasad from Bhagavan. That's the whole karma yoga buddhi. That allows you to be free to pursue these strong desires and still have a mind that has that shanti, the mind of a mumukshu. And you're just respecting the desire. If the desire is not a dharmic, nobody's to be hurt by it, it's probably just your prarabdha playing out, and why not do it? Because that's where your energy is. That's what it gives you, your desire is what gives you the energy to pursue anything. Right? And so that's a strong desire can be really good. It gives you energy to do something, as long as you have that prasada buddhi. Right? It's not necessarily bad. If you think it's bad, then you should think, why do I think this is bad? What am I going to lose by this? And that's a good inquiry. You know. Now, in terms of having a very strong desire for this knowledge, in the Shastra itself, and Swamiji's often talked about this, says that desire is benign. That is a benign desire because it resolves completely in the ananda of your being, which is free of time. Right. And so all other desires, you know, they're binding. If they're a real desire, they're binding in a sense, because the result also is time bound. So they're not going to fulfill you. However, you do have prarabdha karma that takes you from your birth to your death. And that prarabdha karma fulfills itself in three ways. And one of them is somebody else is dragging you into a situation. Another way is that the universe presents the situation to you. It's nobody's fault, good or bad. The universe presents it. But the other is called swecha, swaicha. Your own desire arises from you that engages you in the activity, whatever it is. You know, and so say you're trying to stop that. But you won't be able to, because the whole force of the proverb, the karma, is pushing you in that direction. You know? And so what you find with time, as your mind matures in your knowledge, the desires that are extraneous, that are just picked up because the Joneses are doing it this way or whatever. This person's happy and they're doing that, so let me do that and I'll be happy too. You know, that type of thing. That don't really belong to your prog. Those things all drop off. And what's left are the desires that arise. You know they're prarabdha. You can feel the prarabdha in them because there's nothing, no reason for you to have that desire.
It just seems like the difference is, if I have a strong desire for something else, it's fairly clear to me usually that I'll be okay no matter what happens. But with the desire for self-knowledge, I guess there is a little bit of fear almost, like if
yeah.
I don't know that I'll be okay if I don't.
Yeah, it's a real desire.
Yeah,
yeah, that's the mumukshutvam, the desire for liberation. And they say that that desire, the example they use is like if a, you know, they think of these guys, that these brahmacharis who have this jada on their head of hair. If their hair were to catch on fire, how would they go toward the lake? If your hair were on fire, right, it was burning, how would you go toward the lake? You wouldn't just stroll. You would, you know, do everything to get into that lake. That's mumukshutvam, you know. And there is a lot, there can be a lot of fear. I remember once I had visa problems when I was in India. I was studying with Swamiji. And I actually had to come back to the States to get a visa. And then I had to make money and everything to get back. And the whole thing was terrifying to me. And I did not want to go. And when I got back, then to have to get the right visa and all of these things, it was a hassle, and there was some jeopardy, there was some question, I forget now why, but of whether or not I could get the visa and get the right passport stamp and all of that, all of this stuff. You know, so it was so tense for me because I wanted this knowledge so badly. And when you have a desire like that, then every obstacle becomes huge. You know, because it can stop it from happening. So mumukshas, you know, can suffer. But it resolves. The desire resolves into the promise. You know, the promise of the nature of your own being.
Yeah. Because they could always give you that quick Indian notice, you know. Oh, man.
We used to have so much trouble that Swamiji could pull a lot of strings. The six-month visa. 6 months is not very long, and they aren't giving us student visas or anything, and so we always had to go through all this torture every 6 months to get an extension. And once I had to leave right before the three-year course started. I'd been there for 6 months, and I had to leave for some reason. It didn't work to get the extension. I had to go home and then come back. And after that, it was always just very stressful trying to see if Swamiji could get us an extension and pull strings here and there. And it was a big deal. And then, it was a three-year course, then I used to worry about what would happen when the 3 years were up. You know? I couldn't even bear to think about it. But when the 3 years was up, everything was fine. I was ready to come home. You know, but I remember kind of the agony and worry about all that. I was a youngster. That was intense.
So there's going to be a whole bunch of values here that's going to help out the
Aman itvam dambi.
Do you think it's more difficult for those of us subjected to Western child rearing experience? Or, you know, is it more difficult or just a different balance of
It's just a different balance of challenges.
Okay.
A different balance of
Good.
because the values and the virtues and all of these things, they're kind of part of the buddhi or two, but they're not really highly cultivated in this society either.
Well, I would say there's some real grace to gain that shraddha and that mumukshutvam. You know, and if that is there, if that shraddha with the mumukshutvam is there, all of the other things will be made up for. If there's no mumukshutvam, it's a non-issue, you know, because it doesn't, you're not ready for this particular type of knowledge. It's not an issue for you. Like when I tell the story about my mom when I got back from India and was trying to tell her a little bit about it, she asked me, so I tried to tell her, and I knew that it kind of wasn't working, and she just said, I don't have those kind of problems, honey. You just don't have those kind of problems.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. But you know, the mumukshutvam's not there, the interest isn't there, so... But if that mumukshutvam of sorts is there, then you need the shraddha. And that shraddha, that, you know, Krishna says that shraddha van labhate jnanam. The one who has shraddha, they gain this knowledge. The deficits will be taken care of, whatever they are. They take care of themselves over time. It's all included in the knowledge and the teaching, how to work with all of that.
So you don't have to be an Einstein. I mean...
You just have to be a person who has good mind.
Rod, is that when Swami just speaks about the shraddha suspends the shraddha. I notion?
Oh yeah, he does talk about that. It suspends the ego.
Right.
Because when you're, if the shraddha is there, when you're listening to the teaching is being unfolded, there has to be some shraddha for the teacher and for the teaching. If there's only one, then it's a problem. The other one will be an obstruction. So the teacher shouldn't be in your way, in the way, and the teaching shouldn't be in the way, so that your mind is just available to see what's being taught. It's not blind belief or anything like that. It's an availability where the mind wants to know and wants to know what this knowledge has to say. And this teacher, the shraddha, this teacher is saying what it says. You know, so that otherwise you want this knowledge, but not from her, or not from the teacher. Mm-hmm. You know, and then the mind's not open. It can't relax. Mm-hmm. But if it can relax, then as this teaching takes place, you know, the mind is seeing it, and then it will question what it sees it, and then it has questions about it, and all of that's fine. But it's available. You need shraddha for the mind to be available. You know? Otherwise, how can it work, really? They even talk about shraddha in this way. Like, you have a natural shraddha toward your eyes so that you can use them. Like, if I'm looking at that painting, I'm not thinking, well, can my eyes really help me to see this painting? Should I use these eyes or not? You know, there's total shraddha for the use of that pramana. And when that shraddha is there, then the eyes are doing their job and the vritti is formed. Right? That's shraddha.
What'd you say? Could you say it again?
The mind uses the eyes to perceive. And as the mind uses the eyes with shraddha, those eyes, as a pramana, form a vritti in the mind, and then that is perceived. So now, this teaching, the teaching methodology of the Upanishads is an oral teaching. What's wrong?
She's fiddling with the toilet.
Yeah, I was just telling her to shut the door, but didn't quite get...
Okay, we're listening.
I thought you better need to jiggle it more.
And so say, this teaching itself is an oral tradition. The Upanishads are meant to be taught. There's a teaching methodology that goes along with them. There's a handling of the words, and that's passed on from teacher to student. And so when the tradition, when the teaching is taking place, the mind should just, and the mind of the teacher and the mind of the student, the teacher goes away, the student goes away. That's what they mean about the anhanga. Teacher goes away, student goes away, and then there's just this knowledge that is being seen. Right? Those vrittis are formed in the mind and it's seen. And then, so Swamiji sometimes says for Shraddha, faith pending understanding. It means there's this an openness of the mind to see, you know, and then you do all the Purvapaksha Siddhanta, all of the questioning, whatever your questions are and all of that, you get engaged in it. But how can you see if the mind's not open for it to see? It's not just a lecture that you're taking notes, you know. This teaching's not like just a lecture because it's talking about almost descriptively pointing to something that is here. You know, but it's not really just seen through your eyes. It's your own nature. It's not an object, but the words keep pointing, pushing you to that recognition.
And it's so unique. If the individuality of the teacher vanishes and the individuality of the student is resolved, and it's just what? Just knowledge or just...
It's just knowledge. It's like the mind of the teacher and student. It's like a mind meld in a way because there's nothing in between. There's no ego, there's no ahankara for the teacher or the student coming and interfering with that knowledge that's being passed at that time. Mm-hmm.